Renegade Broadcasting.
Storm is coming. Our storm. And when it arrives, it will shake the universe.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you this Sunday night, February 23rd, 2020. I hope everybody out there is doing well. Please head on over to renegadetribune.com when you've got some time. Check out all of the great posts we have going up there. It's been a busy week. Also, head on over to heathenherbs.com. Do it right now. Check out some of those great products and buy some for you and your loved ones. Now that that advertisement is out of the way, I wanted to get to some current events here at the beginning. Talk a little bit of politics maybe too. Not the boring kind. And then in a little while, we'll talk about some issues dealing with Jews in their minds. But first, I wanted to comment on a big sporting event that took place last night. I know this is not really the norm here at the Solar Storm. I'm not talking about sports events, but it is a sport that I kind of like, and it's an interesting set of characters here, and that'd be boxing, and that'd be Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder. There's a lot to actually unpack about this whole story, which really relates to some of our interests, as I'm sure many of you are well aware. I personally prefer watching MMA. The only real boxing matches I've watched have involved Tyson Fury. Pretty much their first match, and maybe a little bit of, at least the highlights of some of Tyson's other matches, and some of the other people out there. I've seen some highlights from them, the heavyweights. Other than that, I mean, I've seen some amateur boxing in person, but it's just not as entertaining as mixed martial arts. It's not as complicated and fast-paced, in my opinion. But I'll tell you what, the fights between the Gypsy King and the Bronze Bomber have been very entertaining. And that's because Deontay Wilder is this black man in really good shape who has a right hand that can knock out anybody. And it almost did against Tyson Fury in their first fight. What happened was they had... Well, actually, let's go back even further. Tyson Fury had beat Klitschko and then never defended his championship that he had won because he was taking cocaine and staying up all night drinking. He got all fat. The belt was stripped from him, and then he spiraled out into this Great Depression, and then he found Jesus. Thank you, Yeshua. He found Jesus, and apparently that kind of mind control programming has been working very well for him because he got his life together. He got down from, I don't know what he was, like 350 pounds down to fighting weight in a very short period of time, had a couple of warm-up fights, and then went against this legendary champion here, Deontay Wilder, who had the WBC belt. And people weren't really thinking Tyson could do it. But for the most part, for most of the rounds, all 12 of them, Tyson Fury was looking really good. Deontay Wilder couldn't hit a guy that's 6'9", because he was able to kind of rope-a-dope very well. He was playing very well defensively, anticipating all the punches, and landing some of his own, of course, a lot of his own. And they weren't big power punches. And he won, most people think, at least 9 or 10 of the rounds. But there were two rounds where Deontay knocked Tyson down. First one, something like the 7th, something like that. You know, he went down, he got back up. No big deal. And then it was the 12th round. And Deontay Wilder hits Tyson Fury, I think, with a good left and then a good right, or a good right and then a good left, as Tyson was going down. I'm sure many of you know this, but he fell absolutely flat. Flat on his back. I think a lot of referees would have waved it off right there because he looked out cold. He probably was. But then a few seconds later, you know, his eyes open. He does the Undertaker, where he just lifts up his big old body and then sits up, stands up, says, "Oh yeah, I'm fine." And then for the rest of round 12, he was on the attack, just going after Deontay Wilder. A lot of times when people get knocked down and they get back up, they're very defensive because they don't want to get knocked out again. They don't want to get knocked out and just be done with the whole fight. They want to try to protect themselves. Not Tyson. He went after him. He won the rest of the round. So everybody thought that Tyson Fury was going to win the fight, because it doesn't matter that Tyson got knocked down, you know, pretty effectively twice over the course of 12 rounds. He only lost those two rounds. It's a point-based system based on the rounds that a fighter wins or loses. And somehow, magically, it was a draw. It was the most insane judging ever. So Deontay kept his WBC title, and Fury was still the lineal heavyweight champ, which means the guy who beat the guy, going back all the way with all the heavyweight champions. It means you can have a belt, but you might not have beaten the actual champion to get it. And so that's what Tyson, was coming back into this fight, the lineal champ. And you had the Bronze Bomber being the WBC champ. And they were talking a big game the whole time. And Tyson was saying, leading up to this rematch, that I'm going to knock him out. And everybody's just kind of laughing at it. Yeah, you know, Tyson Fury, he's knocked some people out. But to knock out Deontay Wilder, I don't know. And he wasn't really throwing that hard of punches. He got a really nice quick jab, but he wasn't really sticking it to Deontay in the first fight. Well, things did change, but we'll get to that in a second. Let's talk about the pre-fight first, because this is where a lot of the narrative gets established for the fight. And I think there were a lot of people thinking that Wilder was just going to knock this big Irishman down real quick, that he wasn't going to let the mistake of the first fight happen again. And, so first Tyson walks out. He actually doesn't walk out. He's rolled / carried out. And he's sitting on a throne because he's the Gypsy King. Kind of lame, kind of cheesy. To some song from 1960 or something. It was actually quite strange. But, you know, it's kind of part of his character. Weird and kooky. And then, oh, scary Deontay came out. And he was wearing this elaborate costume, like he always does. He's trying to be really intimidating. And it's all about Black Power, Black History Month. And so it sets up this narrative of this kind of race war that is going to take place with a jacked black man who's going to knock out the big goofy Irishman. Well, it's not exactly how it happened. But let's get into the costume and the wrapping that was going on for Deontay's entrance here. It's from Lifestyle magazine. The fight didn't go his way, but the loss shouldn't take the shine off Deontay Wilder's elaborate, intricately designed ring walk outfit. The design by Los Angeles-based costume designers Cosmo and Donato was worth $40,000, according to Wilder. The look covered Wilder's face and featured striking rhinestones along the jawline and brow, with LED lights creating a glow around his eyes. Above the mesh-like face mask was a black crown, and Wilder also wore a long black cape, a chest plate, and skulls as shoulder pads. Red lights also ran down his arms and lit up his shoulders and chest. So intimidating, like a superhero. Wilder said the crazy costume was actually in part a tribute to people who paved the way for the black community in the U.S. It's going to be a big tribute to a lot of men and women that paved the way for us. This is Black History Month, and I'm going to be paying tribute to that, Wilder told TMZ the day before the fight. In a further celebration of Black History Month, Wilder came out to the ring with rapper D-Smoke walking in front of him, performing his song Black Habits. As he and Wilder walked out, D-Smoke rapped, "Black magic, black excellence, black habits. This black medicine, everything. Black chucks, black tux, everything, everything. Black hug, black love, everything. Black pride, black lives, everything." D-Smoke is a teacher from Inglewood who found fame on Netflix's Rhythm and Flow. Nice. So, that's pretty interesting there. And you don't even need to mention, what would happen if a boxer tried to, or an MMA fighter, whoever, tried to go out to someone who's singing about white magic, white excellence, white habits, white medicine, everything, white penny loafers, white tux, everything, everything, white hug, white love, everything, white pride, white lives, everything. Oh, but this was just so celebrated, so cool. And so it made it into something of a race war that was to take place. White versus black. And these are two races that really have dominated at the heavyweight division. You'll see some other people at the lower weights, but white and black is really who has been, it has been the most dominant race, racial components of the heavyweight division. And that's because I think something to do with just stature, build, and I don't know, determination, maybe, hunger. Because I'll tell you what, there used to be a lot more white champions in things like boxing, but I think white people kind of lost their hunger, their drive for something like this. Whereas some black youths saw this as just, you know, a great opportunity. This is something that they were willing to sacrifice a lot for. Unlike maybe, you know, myself, who just wanted to play a little bit of sweet lacrosse, football, things like that. You know, boxing was never, you never even thought about it. Because you also wanted to protect your brain. Brain's a very important asset. But I do see a resurgence, perhaps, of white fighters. You see it a lot in the UFC. Before that boxing match last night, the main event was this guy Dan Hooker from New Zealand versus Paul Felder, an American who calls himself the Irish Dragon, big red beard. These are some of the toughest guys you'll ever see out there. So the fight sports often do kind of give a different perspective on this whole idea that white men are just these, you know, cucked little nerdy sissies that you see in all the commercials. And no matter what they do to try to promote some of the darker fighters, I really do think that there's something that the fans don't connect with. Maybe it's because a lot of the fans who pay to go to the arenas and everything are probably more white. It's probably majority white in there. I'm just guessing. But and they just don't find a compelling connection to some of the personalities of the black fighters. That's not always the case. But just an observation I've had. And you could see when you've got a country, let's say like New Zealand, where this last UFC fight night was taking place, the crowd, a bunch of Kiwis, definitely seemed to favor people that were racially closer to them. They were cheering for them more. Of course, their own hometown people and even the Aussies that were fighting. But they definitely felt like, it seemed like, they wanted to root for the white team, you know. I'm just saying, it's something I've noticed. Something I've noticed. Anyway, you got a race war taking place in the ring last night, and Tyson Fury just brought it to this guy, Deontay Wilder. Wilder barely got any shots off. He got knocked down in the second round, maybe the third. And Tyson was just all over him. Great shots. Deontay Wilder's ears started bleeding. He got knocked down again. His mouth started bleeding. He just looked like a mess. He was very wobbly towards the end. His eardrum had probably ruptured, and so his balance was all off. And in the seventh round, Tyson Fury just gets him into the corner and just starts lighting him up. And Wilder's corner threw in the towel, which pissed off Wilder because he wanted to go out. He wanted to get knocked out. He didn't want to just have to quit, which is in some ways respectable, but you have to understand this. The fight team is looking to protect the health of their fighter. There's no way the guy was going to be winning at any point. And I mean, maybe he could have gotten a real lucky right hand or something, but he was out on his feet is what it looked like. And so Tyson Fury, the big white guy, won the heavyweight championship, and he's the king. I think it is interesting, at least from the racial perspective. And it's also interesting due to some of the things that Tyson has said before in the past about poverty and immigration and also the Zionist Jews. But let me be really clear here. This guy is in business. He's partners with Bob Arum now. If you don't remember, I did some shows with a guy named Raleigh Quaid who really took a bad turn. But he talked a lot about Bob Arum, the Jew of Top Rank promotions. And this is like the guy of boxing and ESPN and all that. And that's who Tyson Fury's in bed with now. In bed with the same people he was speaking out against. But first, let me just play a clip from Tyson from 2015 talking about poverty and immigration. And I think that this is, it's just interesting to listen to because it's a non-PC thing that he's saying, but it's just common sense. And for a while, Tyson was just willing to kind of speak his mind as he saw fit, and he got a lot of trouble for it. He stopped doing that. Now he's all successful. But yeah, let's listen to this from, I think, 2015.
Opportunity to. Let's face it. I'm the most famous person that Morecambe's had in a long time. The most influential person that Morecambe's had in a long time. So, I believe I could do a better job at helping these people than 99.9% of the people who's in power now. Never mind power and all that stuff. I'll tell you what I can do. I can help these poor people get out of a rut. Get them on the road. Get them off the drugs. With the right help and courses, I can help big time. Big time help. And that's what we need. You've got to start, and you've got to attack the virus straight away. Boom. And the rest will all help itself. It's like putting a house up. You've got to put the foundations in right first. There's no good putting marble pillars up and all that stuff without the foundations being in right. So I hope I've not bored you too much with all my politics talking this morning, Tuesday, beautiful morning. But let's face it, we're letting thousands and thousands of immigrants in daily. That's not even from here, born here. But yet we've got our own people dying on the streets, homeless, who can't get anything. They can't get no money, they can't get help. You know, what's going on? What's going on, Great Britain? It's all in the name, Great Britain. Come on. It's not so great, is it, when we're letting our fellow brothers and sisters die on the streets who've been born and bred here, but then we're like 50,000 immigrants in from wherever they're from, crying poverty, and then they're going to blow us up. So, it is what it is. We're pretty fucked up at the moment. And I'm bigger and brave enough to say how it is. I will say how it is.
Well, unfortunately, he had to stop saying how it is. But he did actually make another well, he made a lot of other comments, but this one in particular got him in some really hot water, and it's been pretty much scrubbed from YouTube. They don't want people knowing that the best big boxer in the whole world, the champ, has spoken out against the Jews and their brainwashing. They don't want that known. So I encourage everybody out there to find this clip and share it, because people know who Tyson Fury is now. And that if they can hear somebody who's big and famous speaking out against the Jews, perhaps that will embolden them to do the same.
Whatever you can think of that's bad will be made legal, because that's what the devil wants. The world has gone mad. There is no morals, there is no loyalty, there is no nothing. Everyone just do what you can, listen to the government, follow everybody like sheep, be brainwashed by all the Zionist Jewish people who own all the banks, all the papers, all the TV stations. Be brainwashed by all. Washed by all the Zionist Jewish people who own all the banks, all the papers, all the TV stations. Be brainwashed by all.
All right. There you go. That's really all I had to say about that particular subject. I'm not going to get into, you know, the details of the great things that Tyson did with his boxing. He's just impressive to watch. I just think that it's an interesting racial dynamic that played out there last night with the heavyweight. Now also being somebody who had spoken out against endless immigration and also Jews running everything. It's just pretty interesting. Interesting development, to say the least. Now I want to turn my attention here to an article from the Jerusalem Post about a very interesting Belgian parade, a carnival, that has decided to not only kind of take the same tact as they did last year in satirizing Jews, but they've doubled down and they're going even bigger this year. Belgian carnival to double down on anti-Semitic displays. If the parade goes as planned, it will be a moral blot on Belgium, Ambassador to Belgium Emmanuel Nelson said. Sorry. Scroll too far. The annual carnival in Aalst, Belgium is expected to take place on Sunday with even more anti-Semitic elements than in previous years. Okay, so it took place today, I think. I need to get the photos. Aalst's organizers have sold hundreds of rabbi kits for revelers to dress as Hasidic Jews in the carnival's parade. The kit includes oversized noses, side locks. Guys, remember the shows I did recently? Locks and knots and flowers, how they're all connected, and black hats. The organizers plan to bring back floats similar to the one displayed in 2019, featuring oversized dolls of Jews with rats on their shoulders holding banknotes. As you can hear, somebody did join the call, it sounds like. I will get to them in, or maybe they left the call. Anyway, the call lines are open. This is a live show here tonight, so do call in if you're listening. 747-999-6407. Again, 747-999-6407. Got a decent amount of people in the chat room here. All right. Belgium, as a Western democracy, should be ashamed to allow such a vitriolic anti-Semitic display, Foreign Minister Israel Katz said Thursday. I call upon the authorities there to condemn and ban this hateful parade in Aalst. Ambassador to Belgium Emmanuel Nassan has been outspoken against the parade. It's a great pity that such an anti-Semitic carnival is allowed, he told the Jerusalem Post. Aalst is the only city in Europe where such a carnival is allowed. We call upon Belgian authorities, including city authorities of Aalst, to change their mind. We still have time until the carnival and hope reason will prevail and the anti-Semitic floats will be taken away. If the parade goes as planned, it will be a moral blot on Belgium, Nassan said. The fight against anti-Semitism is also an Israeli fight, he said. Israel has to be very clear on the issue. the Ulst Carnival lost its place on UNESCO's representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity in 2019 after its mayor refused to remove anti-Semitic imagery from the parade. Good on them for not caving to pressure. This year's parade is expected to specifically target Jews for mockery because of the controversy and loss of the carnival's UNESCO status. The carnival has long been a site of bigoted displays in general, including participants in blackface and displays mocking Muslims, and usually of specifically anti-Semitic imagery. In 2013, JTA reported carnival revelers in Nazi uniforms held canisters labeled Zyklon B while walking with other participants dressed as concentration camp prisoners. Unfortunately, this just helps to reinforce their narrative of Zyklon B gassings when all that Zyklon B was used for was to delouse garments. While several Belgian officials have spoken out against the parade, no government action has been taken against it. One reason for this is the rise of Vlaams Belang, a far-right populist party with neo-Nazi roots, and a concern that banning the anti-Semitic floats will play into their hands. Antwerp Mayor Bart De Wever, whose city has a large Jewish community, said last month the parade shows a lack of empathy and is disrespectful. President of B'nai B'rith International, Charles Kaufman, essentially the international Jew here, said that the anti-Semitic imagery in the Ulst Festival is demeaning and disgraceful. It disgraces the community and Belgium. It is not free speech, it is hate speech, and as a matter of respect and dignity, it should be disallowed. How many times do Jews, with their media control, mock and degrade and demean white people and incite violence against white people specifically? But since we don't have any international organizations like B'nai B'rith, we can't really even effectively complain about it. We can't kvetch about it. But they can kvetch endlessly over all of the major outlets because they own them all. And it's always the Jewish message that's the one getting out there. Some people may view the imagery as good fun, but the determining factor is that the caricatures are images that incite hate and violence. How do we know? It is proven by history, actual events. Shame! Kaufman added. Shonda! Shonda! Though Belgium, with a population of around 11 million, has some 30,000 Jews, the Jewish community is not planning any demonstrations against the carnival. Good on the Belgians. All right, back with more. Take care. Murder.
Is it the aliens?
Wrong.
Is it the military-industrial complex?
Wrong.
Is it the Illuminati?
Wrong.
Is it the Freemasons?
Wrong.
Jesuits, Vatican, Satanists?
Wrong. Wrong. Wrong.
I don't know then. I mentioned all of them whom they talk in the media about.
Do you want to know who is it?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Then listen to the most honest...
Stop. I want to know now.
It's... the Jews. It's always been the Jews. Learn more at the hard-hitting talk radio Renegade Broadcasting.
Calling out your name as loud as I can without sounding bad. You've been within sight and looking out. So if you could hear me from where you've been standing, you'd have heard me by now. I am the sun, that's all I've ever been since I began. Ever. to hurt no one. But there's nothing I can do about waking up the sky while you're trying to lie in your bed.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. I have a caller on the line, so I'll take this before getting on to any other topics here. Caller from Tennessee, who's this? Do I have it muted? Yeah, I do. I'm sorry, sorry. One more time. Who's this?
Nick from Tennessee.
Nick, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to add another great white fighter. Probably the greatest of modern times is Fedor, or how do you say it? Fedor. It's F-E-D-O-R.
Yeah, Emelianenko.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's probably by far by far like at the top or whatever.
And like Tyson, you see his body, you're not thinking that this is going to be a guy who can finish almost anybody, because he's got a little extra fat around him. He doesn't look like the really ripped black fighters that they have out there. But man, this guy's scary. And he only lost like 5 fights after, I don't know his record, but he's fought so many times for so many years, and he's barely lost. He's beat some of the biggest people out there in the sport. And yeah, I'd agree. He's one of the best.
Yeah. In his prime, he won for, I think, over a decade straight, but he won all his fights in his prime. But the reason why he lost fights now is because he's like kind of like past his prime, but he still beats people for the most part.
Yeah. And once you kind of break the seal with getting knocked out, it makes it so that you can get knocked out much easier the next time. So whereas you might have once been able to just weather the storm as somebody's hitting you right across the jaw, you're no longer able to take that, and you just go out. And that's really what takes out a lot of the fighters, you know, maybe somewhere in their mid to late 30s. It's not that they can't physically get in as good of shape anymore. It's just that their chin can't take it.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing, Fedor, I don't know why, but he tends to strike more now. But he don't really use his well-rounded skills. Now, when he does, he still wins to this day, like, because especially the Sambo. The Sambo is a very interesting martial art to look into. I guess since a lot of people in MMA don't really seem to use that martial art, I guess it can be used as an advantage in combat sports, because not many people use it, I think.
Well, doesn't Khabib have a Sambo background?
Yeah.
I mean, he's obviously a wrestler, and he's well-versed in jiu-jitsu and just MMA in general. But, Sambo's an interesting one. They use the gi top and then shorts. So it's very interesting looking when you see him out there. They do a lot of interesting trips and sweeps and things.
Yeah, exactly. And another interesting thing about Fedor is I don't exactly know his politics, but he does come out to beautiful Russian cultural type of music, and it's very prideful in his people and his culture and his country. And the way he comes out, you can just feel that pride and passion in his own people and his own culture and country. And it's such a great feeling. Like, just as much as his fights, just seeing Fedor come out to his music and his interests is just as exciting as his fights are most of the time.
Yeah, and a big contrast to this would be Conor McGregor. Although he starts off with the Foggy Dew, which is a good song. It's actually a nationalist type of song where the main message is, don't go and fight and die for your enemies, your oppressors, which would have been England. It was referencing the 1916 uprising, the Easter uprising, and also just the fact that about 200,000 Irishmen fought for the Brits in World War I. The song was saying, no, don't do that. Don't go fight for your oppressor. It's better to fight and die here on your own soil so your land might be free. So yeah, he starts off with that song, and then it turns into Notorious by Notorious B.I.G.
I know, that's so terrible, man. It's like, gosh.
In my opinion, he's a disgrace to Irish people. Just the tattoos and everything. I'm not saying a fighter can't have tattoos, but he just looks like an idiot.
Yeah, and it's sad that he, like you're saying, runs such a beautiful song and then mix it in with rap. That's just it's such a big difference, man. Just so sad.
And it does. I mean, he still is an interesting case with a white fighter. He is very talented. You could see this in the Floyd Mayweather fight. Also, it seems like he's a big freaking homo because you see before in one of the weigh-ins or something, he's out there in his underwears with a boner, you know, trying to intimidate Floyd Mayweather. Very, very strange. But with the fight itself, he took at least three of the first rounds as somebody who had never even competed in a boxing match against the best boxer in his weight class.
Yeah, and another crazy thing is how a lot of these whites support sport athletes, especially black athletes. And because I'm thinking, like, you know, our ancestors' teams, if you want to call it that, our tribes or whatever, and our individual ancestors and all that, they were way tougher, smarter, more manly, more athletic. Even probably the farmers, I think there were studies done on the farmers' bones of the ancient times, and they found out that their bones were even a lot stronger than modern day professionals. And so I'm just thinking, like, you know, that it's kind of like disrespectful to your ancestors that you're sitting there worshiping and celebrating sport athletes when you should really look up to your ancestors' toughness and willpower and masculinity and all that. It's just amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, what you were saying about just how our ancestors were so superior to how we are today, physically and mentally as well, I'd add. I was reading this book last year about the white Indians of the Canary Islands. They're pretty much extinct now, but they were a white tribe who ended up making their way to the Canary Islands off the coast of Africa a long time ago, back in the Stone Age days. And because of the lack of resources that they had, all they had there were stones. It was a Stone Age culture, essentially, living alongside modern Europe. And then it was maybe it was the French or Spanish who had gone there and fought against them. And it wasn't really a fair fight, of course. But that, you know, that being said, in terms of just the technological capabilities, these people were exceptional athletes. They were amazing warriors. It was well noted. And so maybe some of our greatness was perhaps lost with some of the technological innovations that came along. I'm not a Luddite, but I think maybe there's something to the kind of the hardness of being a little bit more connected to the earth that we've lost.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I encourage all the other white guys, like, to go out and, like, exercise and stuff, and especially out in the cold or any kind of elements of nature and anything. I'm constantly doing that. And then, but you'll see other white guys, like, if they do come out and do any kind of exercise, a lot of the times they're listening to rap music, or they get with their friends, listen to rap music and smoking and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, it's like always try to inspire people. I know it can get you down, but always try to inspire people to go to your ancestors' spirit and that toughness that's within in our soul, you know?
Yeah, you know, I see this way too much. Just the white guys who otherwise look like decent white guys, they're in shape, and they're just getting all pumped up by some Jewish-produced rap music. It's just so disgusting. Yep. And especially with the walkouts and everything, you see this all the time with the white guys, except in a few cases, especially when it's people from other countries, like, as you said, the Russian music, or maybe some other Slavic country, or, you know, you'll see some of these white people have this kind of national pride and play the music of their people. But white people in the Western world, we've just been so disconnected from our real cultural roots. That they don't even know what they would play, you know? Or if they do play something that's supposedly white, it's some degenerate rock music.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I agree. We need to definitely be inspired by our people, our past. And I just wanted to add that sports can be a good way to have, I'd say, beneficial race relations. The kind of the spirit of the Olympic Games, which you could see on full display in the 1936 Olympics in Germany, where you've got these people, these very different people, the Germans and some of the blacks and everything, you know, having a good time, getting to meet each other briefly, compete against each other, and this forms some good bonds. Now, this has been used, the sports have been used against us in terms of integration, because it does actually form bonds when you're playing on the same team as people of other races. But if you think about this internationally, so that we're not just always at war with one another, sports could be a very beneficial thing. But the Olympics now mean almost nothing, because these big countries that were once white don't even care about even trying to bring up their own citizens to be great athletes. They'll sometimes just basically go buy athletes from other countries, bring them over, and it's just a big, you know, hodgepodge. You've got the USA team, and it's all the different races of the planet out there competing against some of these small countries who basically don't stand a chance. What do you think? Anything?
Yes, like, it's just, I always try to, like, encourage people to form groups in a, like, especially with my own people, my own white fellow people, and like, it seems like nobody really wants to do anything. It's just, it's like, that spirit needs to be, that fire needs to be lit, and it's like, I can feel it inside of me, but I don't see how they don't have that, like, you know, it's just...
Unfortunately... Some people do want to do just that, but what I'll tell you is that you get let down time and again by either the quality of the characters that you meet or the realization that they're probably working for the enemy, because our enemy has spent a lot of time and money making sure we're so thoroughly infested and infiltrated that, especially if you're a well-known, let's say, talk radio host and website publisher, you're not necessarily going to be dealing with honest white folks who are out there just trying to meet up. So I understand why people are hesitant. I've been burned a lot of times, but it's something that you really yearn for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Like, especially when you go out there and like in the cold and stuff, or in the cold rain and like it was just like shorts on or something, and you're like putting yourself in the ancestors' mindset and trying to endure a little bit of what they endured. It makes you feel real close to your ancestors, and people ask me why I do stuff like that, and I tell them, like, you know, it's to feel close to my ancestors and tap into that spirit and get some benefits from it, you know, to feel alive.
Yeah,
and, you know,
swimming in cold water, that's a good one. Hey, or even towards the end of your shower, just turning the water on cold. You want to feel a little bit of that, what our ancestors went through when they'd, you know, bathe sometimes? Get that refreshing cold water.
Exactly.
It's the Roman decadence. You know, they brought that really weakens people sometimes. Like, they brought their bathhouses to Britain when they were conquering the Celts there, and it made them soft. They thought they were gaining something, but in reality, this was just destroying them. But here's the thing. I say that, but a nice, you know, public kind of bathhouse or swimming pools and things like the Romans had, that's pretty freaking appealing. I understand why they did it. Not the bathhouses like the rabbis and the bathhouses like Dickie Spencer and the rest would like to frequent. Those aren't the kind I'm talking about. But hey, Nick, I got some other stories to get to. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, thank you for what you do, man. Thanks.
All right, take care. All right. Talked a bit more about fighting and everything. It's an interesting subject. Let's now talk about Trump, a less interesting subject, but still relevant, as he is our Zog Emperor. So he just appointed this pro-Israel, anti-Iranian ambassador. This guy just hates Iran, loves Israel. His name is Richard Grenell. And he appointed the ambassador as the acting intelligence chief. So this guy is also the first openly gay person to serve in a cabinet level position. So big kudos to Trump for that. Whoa, progressive. Grinnell is known for his pro-Israel and anti-Iran stance. The Jerusalem Post says that about him. For Israel's security and defense establishment, Grinnell's hawkish views towards Iran's regime will be welcomed with open arms, Foundation for Defense of Democracies fellow Benjamin Weinthal said. Charlie Kirk was all for this, the guy from Talking Points USA. Richard Grinnell, tough on Iran, pro-Israel. Nancy Pelosi hates him. The media attacks him. Sounds like he's the perfect guy for the job. Not an exact quote. Though Grinnell officially has been the ambassador to Germany, he really seems like the Israeli ambassador. Get some of these tweets and everything from a news article from Information Liberation. I find like a few diamonds in the rough over there. Oh, here's a little tweet this guy put out. I'm in Israel, and while life goes on in this beautiful country, people are on edge. Hamas is just down the coast firing 650 rockets into Israel. Oy vey, Richard Grinnell. The sodomite is the acting intelligence chief. Yes. Friday night at the Western Wall. That sounds like a good time. Let's see if the video is any good. No, I can't even play it here. Never mind. I stand with Israel. PM Netanyahu briefed us tonight, and I fully support his position on stopping terrorist attacks. This is nothing new. He's talking about how Palestinians are homophobes. This is nothing new. LGBT rights are celebrated in Israel, but not in the Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv Pride is huge. Gigantic, actually. I'm so thankful Israel stands firmly for LGBT rights in a region that doesn't. We stand with Israel. No country should be pressured to not act against terrorism. Find all those who fund terrorism and stop them. Trump is the most pro-Jewish president, pro-Zionist Jewish, especially president, you know, right-wing Likudnik ever. And yet, look at all the people who are still pushing for him this time around. People who are supposedly Jew-wise. Oh, well, do you want Bernie? Do you want Bloomberg? Or Pete Buttigieg? Buddy Geig? You want the Buddy Geig? Here's one. After announcing the new American Air flights from Germany to the U.S. today, I stopped by the Israel Tourism Hall. I highly recommend it. This guy just loves Israel. Just down on his knees for Israel. Democrats and Republicans should come together and fulfill Richard Holbrooke's plan to see Israel join the Security Council in 2019. Our word is our bond. Rally WEOG members. The election is in June. It isn't too late. Ridiculous. There's more, but I think you get the point. This guy just loves anal sex and Israel. This kind of leads me to something else Trump was recently doing here. Trump had retweeted this guy who was promoting this Bollywood homosexual film. So Bollywood hadn't really put out a big, you know, sodomy fest film yet. So this was a momentous occasion. I don't know why this article is not opening up. But the guy he retweeted was... Let me just go back to the last article, because I think I could find it, that tweet there. Okay, here we go. Okay, so the... Okay. Yeah. No, I got the other article up. Sorry about that. So, Trump retweeted Peter Tatchell. That's the guy's name. And so, Peter Tatchell is this guy who's been very active in the gay community for a while. And so he writes, India, a new Bollywood rom-com featuring a gay romance is hoping to win over older people following the decriminalization of homosexuality. Hurrah! And so Trump retweets and he says, great! Exclamation point. Here's the thing about Peter Tatchell. Unfortunately, as this is a live show and things are not going as I exactly wanted them to, I've got to pull up the exact quote for Tatchell. But he has promoted pedophilia in a big way in the past. This guy's known for it. Okay. I can't find exactly what it is I'm looking for. Rational Wiki might not be the best place to go for the source. Okay, here we go. I'm pretty sure this is legitimate because I've seen it elsewhere. I'm not telling you to take Rational Wiki at face value, at their word. But in 1997, this Peter Tatchell, who Trump retweeted, sent a letter to The Guardian on the subject of pedophilia. So let's read this here. Not too long. ROS coward, who dares to speak nothing? What? Why dares to speak, says nothing useful, June 23rd. So he's referring to an article. This guy thinks it's shocking that Gay Men's Press has published a book, Dares to Speak, which challenges the assumption that all sex involving children and adults is abusive. I think it is courageous. The distinguished psychologist and anthropologist cited in this book deserves to be heard, offering a rational, informed perspective on sexual relations between younger and older people. They document examples of societies where consenting intergenerational sex is considered normal, beneficial, and enjoyable by old and young alike. Professor Gilbert Hurd points to the Sambia tribe of Papua New Guinea, where all young boys have sex with older warriors as part of their initiation into manhood. Sounds like Milo, huh? Far from being harmed, Professor Hurd says the young boys grow up to be happy, well-adjusted husbands and fathers. The sodomy is good for them. The positive nature of some child-adult sexual relationships is not confined to non-Western cultures. Several of my friends, gay and straight, male and female, had sex with adults from the ages of 9 to 13. None feel they were abused. All say it was their conscious choice and gave them great joy. While it may be impossible to condone pedophilia, it is time society acknowledged the truth that not all sex involving children is unwanted, abusive, and harmful. Should this be surprising to you that Trump would retweet somebody who is known for having said this, written this in The Guardian, considering that Trump is so tied to many child traffickers, child rape ring runners, and all of them are Jews, of course, Epstein, Roy Cohn, his mentor, and that Trump would actually use the same lawyers who defended Epstein to basically defend him in the latest impeachment hearing. Isn't that something? You call in the Dersh will get the job done. He defends the pederast very well. Not even pederast, because this was involved. Pederast is man on boy, which is what Milo was all about. Another Donald Trump connection, Milo being a huge Trump shill and a big part of the alt-right for quite some time. Now let's take a look real quickly at Trump's pardon, his recent pardon. We know about the Jewish drug trafficker who was pardoned from Florida after he was putting out a lot of synthetic pot on the market, which is just wreaking devastation on communities. Yeah, he had to let that guy go because, yeah, you know, his kids were sad and stuff. And, of course, Shalom Rubashkin, who was running that kosher slaughterhouse where he was using illegal immigrants, running some kind of fraudulent financial scam. And he was also running a meth lab out of there. That's what the FBI report said. But, of course, they never really followed up on that meth lab that was being run out of agriprocessors. Yeah, so the latest guy that Trump pardoned here is Michael Milken, another Jewish criminal. And he was known as the junk bond king of the 1980s. He had pled guilty in 1990 to racketeering and securities fraud charges from when he was heading the bond department of the defunct investment bank Drexel Burnham Lambert. So he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but using his Jewish privilege card, the term was actually reduced to 2 years. Because Milken had cooperated with federal authorities in the investigation. He was fined $600 million. So, he was fined $600 million. Do you think he paid that? And if he did pay that, how much was he left with? Because after all of this, he became a big Jewish philanthropist. Of course, not donating to Goyim, but donating to Jewish causes and things. Yes. Here's a quote from JTA. Milken, who also gives to Jewish philanthropic endeavors in health and human services, as well as Israeli causes, was among 11 acts of clemency issued by Trump on Tuesday, according to reports. And who was it that wanted this guy to be pardoned? Well, none other than Trump's main money man, the money bags, Sheldon Adelson, the Jewish casino magnate, who said that he was ashamed that he wore an American military uniform instead of an Israeli one, though his wife, who got the Presidential Medal of Freedom or something, yeah? His wife had served in the IDF, apparently, and their son was going to serve in the IDF. Yeah, Sheldon Adelson, he's the one who has basically funded all of the GOP shills out there. So when you see somebody saying how the Democrats are the worst thing ever and we just need to make sure that they're beaten, you're essentially doing Sheldon Adelson's bidding. No, I'm not for the Democrats, of course. That doesn't mean I'm for the Republicans. And if you don't know that, you haven't been listening. So it wasn't just Mr. Sheldon Adelson. It was also one Bob Kraft, the Patriots owner. I actually used to live not too far from his summer home when I lived on Cape Cod. And this guy is a real piece of work. He loves Israel. He's a Jew. Loves Israel. Brought a bunch of NFL players over there for this big thing in Israel. And this guy just loves Jews. So it was Kraft and Sheldon Adelson both pushing to have this guy, Milken, released. All right, back soon.
In a room all alone, waiting by the telephone, with a tear in his eye and a pen in his hand, so begins the diary of a working man.
Do you have a hard time pronouncing some of the ingredients in your personal care products? Do you even know what those chemicals are? You should. Everything you put onto your body ends up getting into your body, so you better be sure that you are using quality products every day. We know it's often hard to find really good natural products, and when you do find them, they're often very expensive. That's why we have Heathen Herbs. Give us a try. We have affordable herbal tinctures, tooth powder, deodorant, muscle salves, creams, beeswax, cling wrap, gift baskets, magnesium, iodine, throat spray, face spray, hairspray, cleaning spray, bug spray, linen spray, and so much more. We're coming out with new products all the time so that you can replace all the corporate crap. Use coupon code RENEGADE for 10% off everything at heathenherbs.com.
Flying too close to this. Renegade Broadcasting. Hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. So you know how Trump is essentially the most pro-Zionist president in U.S. history? He's still called a Nazi, of course. But you know who else has just been called essentially a Nazi? Or Hitler? Bernie Sanders, yeah. Bernie Sanders is the new Hitler. Doesn't matter that he's a Bolshevik Jew. Chris Matthews, he's a... He's in some hot water now. People calling for his resignation after he compared Sanders' victory to a Nazi invasion, one of France. MSNBC's Chris Matthews is under fire after comparing Senator Bernie Sanders' decisive win in Nevada to the Nazi invasion of France in 1940, with some on social media calling for the hardball host to resign. So he said, I was reading... let's just listen to it. Of course, the whole Twitter thing. Yeah. I hate these Twitter videos. For some reason, on this browser, I have to click through to actually get to Twitter. I can't just play it from an embedded article. Embedded in an article. All right, but this is important. We need to listen to Chris Matthews.
On here, and is this any way to pick a nominee?
Well, I don't think so, but it is the way we're picking this one, and it looks like Bernie Sanders is hard to beat right now. I'm with Carville all the way in terms of the dangers of what lies ahead in November. I'm very much aware of them. They're sitting on so much Oppo research on Bernie, what he said in the past about world affairs, how far left he is. I'm not sure how far left he is, but they're going to make the most of that in terms of world politics. They're going to kill him. But I think it's a little late to stop him, and I think that's the problem. By the way, if you look at the pattern, it's dynamic. Bernie won the popular vote in Iowa. He won it again in New Hampshire. It looks like he's going to win it here when they finally get a vote. Bernie's been winning consistently, and I think it's mathematically understandable. Every time we poll, every time Steve and everybody polls, two-thirds of the Democratic vote, two-thirds of people who call themselves Democrats are either liberal or very liberal. All Bernie ever had to do, and he's done it beautifully, is get a majority of that, and he's up to the mid-30s. If you get half of 67, you're into the mid-30s, and that's where he's gotten it a little better. Biden, his only prayer was to consolidate the third of the vote that's moderate and conservative. And he got nowhere near clearing that field, nowhere near. That's split up four ways now. And so with new people coming in, Deval Patrick came in, he didn't make it. Bloomberg is in, he's probably going to survive a bit longer because of his money. But that field wasn't cleared. The only way Biden could win in that one-third of the vote that's either moderate or conservative is to sweep it. He got nowhere near. Bernie, on the other hand, did his job. He got more than a majority of that 67%. That is the name of the game. It is pretty much over unless that changes. I was reading last night, Brian, I know you're a history guy too. I'm reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940, and the general, Renault, calls up Churchill and says, it's over. And Churchill said, how can it be? You got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over? He said, it's over. So I had that suppressed feeling. I can't be as wild as Carville, but he is damn smart, and I think he's damn right on this one. Joy.
It's just funny to hear Bernie Sanders' victory compared to the Nazis taken over France. It's over. Bernie's the new Hitler. But people calling for Chris Matthews to resign for this, there are so many things you could call for Chris Matthews to resign for. This isn't one of them. Just ridiculous how, and you say anything. You say anything at all. You fire that person. He said something I didn't really like. He compared that Bolshevik Jew to Hitler. I don't like that. I didn't know it was going to be that long. I had to wait 2 minutes to hear him talk about the invasion of France. Sorry about that, guys. Try not to play too much Chris Matthews for you here. So, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. It's all stupid. So, there you go. There's that. Now, what I want to get to is something a bit more interesting. Mental illness and the Jews. I saw this article come out this week, and I thought, this didn't come out this week. Oh. I need to find the one that just came out. Well, I don't think I've got that one. All right, you know what? I'm going to start off with this one, then we'll get to another one. Or maybe this was the one I was thinking. I don't know. I write about mental illness because I have one. Oh, and I'm shocked. This is by Diane Weber Betterman. I am the third generation. I am named for my paternal grandmother, Deborah. And she had depression, as did my father. I was diagnosed in my late 40s with chronic recurrent depression. That means that there are times when everything is tickety-boo. What? And others that are very, very dark. I was diagnosed when I was suicidal. The upside is that according to my psychiatrist at the time, I was one mere check mark away from being diagnosed manic depressive. I still have moments of jubilant, blissful joy. Mental illness affects approximately 20-25% of the population. Either number is frightening. New research indicates that mental illness has genetic components and epigenetic causes, markers that can profoundly affect behavior. A modern version of nature nurture, or in the old days, it's your mother's fault. Epigenetics deals with the concept of switches that turn our genes on and off. The environment plays a role, from in the uterus to personal life experiences. For example, I come from a family history of depression and anxiety. My life experiences, from getting lost when I was 4 at the CNE, at one time Canada's largest exhibition, hundreds of thousands of people there on any given day, too much information, Diane, to an unexpected life-threatening condition as a result of a medical error, along with major changes in my personal life. Flicked a switch. Perhaps if those events had not taken place, my switches would not have been activated. I have triggers for my depression, and I would try to avoid them, but there is one trigger I cannot avoid. Hateful, disparaging, irrational comments about Jews and Israel. Although they make me ill, I won't turn away. But I began to wonder, are Jewish people more prone to mental illness than other populations? Does being hated make one more prone to mental illness? I did a quick Google search, looking for studies on the frequency of Jewish mental illness versus the rest of the world. There have been several studies requesting volunteers from the Ashkenazi community to help scientists understand the biological basis for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Yeshiva University professor Rabbi Moshe Tedla, a medical ethicist, has expressed concerns about studies focusing only on Ashkenazi Jews. He stated that genetic studies will reawaken the idea that Jews carry genes that are polluting the world. That's the basis of eugenics. If you have a disease gene, don't you owe it to society not to propagate that gene? That's what you Jews are saying to us about whiteness. That's exactly what you're saying. Well, not exactly, but very, very close. The Johns Hopkins program explained, due to a long history of marriage within the faith, which extends back thousands of years, the Jewish community has emerged from a limited number of ancestors and has a similar genetic makeup. This allows researchers to more easily perform genetic studies and locate disease-causing genes. Results of the studies. Scientists estimate the incidence of schizophrenia in the Ashkenazi Jewish population to be no higher than that of the general population, about 1%. But I can understand Professor Tendler's fears. Here's a piece of research from Dr. Arnold Hushnecker. By the way, that's schizophrenia study. I've got some other contradictory information about that later. But from Dr. Arnold Hushnecker, the longtime psychiatrist, of Richard Nixon, a tad anti-Semitic himself. They just need to add, if this person has ever said anything that we Jews do not approve of, we're going to have to put that little anti-Semite checkbox next to him. The world would be more compassionate towards Jews if it was generally realized that Jews are not responsible for their condition. So this is what this Dr. Arnold Hushnecker was saying. We'd be more compassionate to them if we just understood their condition, or that they're not responsible for it. Quote, schizophrenia is the fact that creates in Jews a compulsive desire for persecution. One, while Jews attack non-Jewish Americans for racism, Israel is the most racist country in the world. Yes, true. Two, the world would be more compassionate towards the Jews if it was generally realized that Jews are not responsible for their condition. Schizophrenia is the fact that creates in Jews a compulsive desire for persecution. Three, the Jew hopes that you retaliate in kind, and when you do, he can tell himself you are anti-Semitic. Four, the incidence of mental illness has increased in the United States in direct proportion to the increase in the Jewish population. It's not just that there are more Jews and that's why we're more, you know, crazier these days. It's because the Jews are spreading their insanity, especially because they control all the media. In 1900, and they're all the psychologists and psychiatrists too, not all, but a lot. In 1900, there were 1.06 million Jews in the United States, with 62,112 American confined to public mental hospitals. In 1970, the Jewish population increased to 5.87 million, an increase of 454.8%, not a good figure, with 339,027 Americans hospitalized for mental disease. Jews are bringing the plague, essentially. There is no doubt in my mind, Dr. Hushnecker said, that Jews have infected the American people with schizophrenia. Jews are carriers of the disease, and it will reach epidemic proportions unless science develops a vaccine to counteract it. Huh. We've heard about anti-Semitox. What is this one going to be called? The real scientists say we don't carry more mental illness than others. I won't argue with that. I try never to base an opinion on feeling, but I feel more at home here. So I'm going to write a very rare opinion based on my feelings. Does it actually sound all that odd that the Jews could have a greater incidence of mental illness? When I check to verify the extraordinary comments by Hushnecker, I'm on sites that are not Jewish friendly. Did this man say these things? That they are said and repeated, especially amongst those who hate us, is my point. We've had about 2,000 years of being hated by Catholics and then Protestants for killing Christ. And all those Goyim children with the Jewish ritual murder, that played a part too, and the usury, and yeah. Played out in persecutions, pogroms, expulsions, mass murder. God, it's not because they think you just murdered the Jews. They also thought you're the chosen one. It was your actions. Come on. It's these crazy Christians, it's Christ, you know, they thought we killed Christ, so they're persecuting us today. It's not that. Although for decades popes have said that this has got to stop, it takes time for the internalized, often unconscious, hate to go away. Then along comes Islamic hate. And we are blessed with our own home group, Jewish detractors of Jews, like Canadians Naomi Klein and Judy Rebick, one of the more radical professors at Ryerson University in Toronto, and Noam Chomsky. Yeah, he's totally an anti-Semite. There are 7 billion people on the planet. 14 million are Jews, and apparently we are still the greatest cause of SIRIS everywhere. Whatever SIRIS is, I am sure you are responsible for it. You are the cause. And people wonder why we are depressed, anxious, and perhaps a tad paranoid. Be well. Oh, what a clever writer you are, Diane. Now, I want to turn to just a couple paragraphs out of Haaretz about this Ashkenazi gene that increases schizophrenia. In that article from 2013 out of Times of Israel, she's saying, yeah, there's not actually any more schizophrenia within the Jewish population than others. Israeli and American scientists have discovered a gene among Ashkenazi Jews that increases their chances of developing the mental disorder schizophrenia, as well as schizoaffective disorder and manic depression. According to a study recently published in Nature Communications, the gene in question raises Ashkenazi Jews' chances of experiencing the disorders by roughly 40% and by 15% in the general population. So, this gene raises the Jews' percentage, chance of experiencing the disorder to about 40%. Roughly 1% of the population is affected by schizophrenia. Those with the disease lose interest in their surroundings, develop dark emotions, and sometimes imagine hearing voices or seeing figures that do not exist. Many scientists believe that genes have a great deal of influence on the disease, alongside other environmental and hereditary factors. So, let's think about the schizophrenia among the Jews. Is this why Abraham was chosen? Are the chosen schizophrenic? I would have to say so. So, Abraham was pretty much an obvious paranoid schizophrenic. He wasn't inspired by God on high. This guy was hearing voices in his head. What would you do if you heard a voice in your head saying, "Hey, it's me. I'm your God. I'm Yahweh. Why don't you murder your son for me?" If you listened to it, you'd be arrested, thrown in prison, rightfully so. If you ever hear that kind of voice in your head, just assume it's Mossad with some kind of high-tech beam blasting into your brain. Don't listen to the voice. Don't listen to Yahweh if he tells you to murder your son. Really, do you think that there would be a any kind of clemency given to somebody who's saying, "Well, yeah, I did murder my son. I sacrificed him, but God was telling me to do so." Actually, you know what? In our Christ-started America, there would be definitely a big preference given to somebody who's really genuinely just saying, "I just love God so much. I was following in the steps of Abraham." As compared to somebody who was saying, "Oh, yeah, I sacrificed that child for the devil." You know, still, they'd probably both get convicted. But I would be interested to see the sentencing. There could be a difference. Yeah, but the religious people definitely have a little sympathy for the insane, because they are Christ insane, just to varying degrees. It's murder, really. So I wanted to actually just play a video. It's a little bit on the longer side, but it just goes over the whole Abraham story. And this guy is the epitome of being insane, very mentally ill, using the PC term for it, even though that's probably not even the one we're supposed to be using anymore. We talk about mental health. Oh, and they want to lock up anybody that thinks that white people shouldn't be genocided or believes in these crazy conspiracy theories about Jews controlling things. But this is the kind of stuff that's allowed, this kind of insanity. And the great Abrahamic religions, of course, trace their lineage back to Abraham. So let's learn about this guy. This is basically a pro-Abraham video, but it tells you the story. So in case you haven't been following up on your Bible study recently, this is just a little bit of a refresher.
A long time ago in the land of Canaan, there lived a good and noble man named Abraham. He was an important man because God picked his family to play a part in the plan to rescue the whole world. In order to set this plan in motion, God made a covenant with him. A covenant is like a big promise that lasts forever, and God's covenant with Abraham was a special one. One cool night, God told Abraham to look up at the sky. "How many stars do you see?" he asked. Abraham gazed up into the cloudless sky, which was lit up in every direction with thousands of stars, as far as he could see. He knew that he could not count them if he tried, so he answered, "I do not know. There are too many to count." God already knew how many stars there were, but he was using it as an example to show Abraham just how big of a promise he was making. "I am going to give you more children in your family than there are stars in the sky." Abraham was very surprised to hear this. He loved the thought of having a huge family, but there was one problem. He and his wife Sarah weren't able to have any children, and now they were too old. It seemed impossible, but Abraham chose to trust God and believe his promise. And 10 years later, God kept that promise. Abraham and Sarah had a son named Isaac. Abraham loved God with all of his heart, and he was so thankful for the blessings that God had given to him. However, God was about to put that love to the test. In the days of Abraham, one of the ways that people showed their love and thankfulness was by bringing sacrifices to God. A sacrifice is like a gift. It's something that you give to God to show him that you are willing to obey him, even when it costs you something. Usually, people would sacrifice an animal, like a lamb or a goat. But when Isaac was still a young boy, God asked Abraham for a different kind of sacrifice. God said to him, "This year, when you bring me your sacrifice, instead of killing an animal and giving it to me, I want you to give me your only son, Isaac." Abraham was shocked. "No, not Isaac," he thought. "How can I possibly kill him? How can I give his life away?" But Abraham remembered God's covenant promise. God told him, "I will make you the father of many nations." Abraham knew that could not happen without a son, so he decided to trust God even though he did not know how it would work out. The next morning, Abraham got up early and gathered the supplies that they would need for the sacrifice and the journey up the mountain. He rounded up Isaac, kissed Sarah goodbye, and began the 3-day journey to the place where they offered sacrifices to God. Isaac had been on these trips with Abraham several times, and along the way, he realized that something was missing.
"Father, we forgot to bring something for the sacrifice," Isaac said to Abraham.
Abraham replied, "Do not worry, son. God will provide for us a sacrifice." Abraham was quiet the rest of the trip, and Isaac could tell that something was not quite right. When they reached the top, Isaac began helping his father build an altar out of stones, all the while wondering what they were going to sacrifice. After they had finished placing the firewood on top of the altar, Abraham sat down with Isaac to explain what God was asking him to do. With tears filling his eyes, Abraham said, "Son, I love you so much. You are a gift from God to us, and he has asked me to offer you as a sacrifice to him. As much as it hurts me, I am going to put my trust in our God." Isaac did not fully understand, but he trusted his father as much as his father trusted God, so he agreed. Abraham wept as he tied up his precious son and laid him on the altar they just built together. He reached for his knife, tears streaming down his face, and raised it in the air. More than anything, he wanted to cut his son free, but he knew what he had to do. He took one last look at his son and said, "I love you, my boy." And with that, he reached out the knife above Isaac, with his hand shaking and his heart hurting. He was willing to obey God and take the life of his only son. Suddenly, just before Abraham went through with the sacrifice, he heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Stop!" Abraham froze. He knew that voice. It was God. "I don't want you to kill the boy," God continued. "I want him to live. I now know that you love me because you were willing to sacrifice your only son."
Abraham fell to his knees and thanked God, grateful that he would not lose his son. He cut Isaac loose and gave him the biggest hug a father has ever given his son.
Okay, that's enough. Oh, man. People love this. They'll defend this. It was just testing him. What kind of sick, psychopathic God would test him like this? And it probably wasn't God testing him. This guy was probably a schizophrenic, and he passed on his schizophrenic genes to all of his descendants. And if he was actually speaking with some kind of creature, he's a madman speaking with some kind of insane demon. No! This is not somebody to look up to, Father Abraham. This is not somebody to hold in high regard. But look at the devastation that the Abrahamic religions have done in this world. It's so telling. It makes sense. They're freaking insane. They're absolutely insane. Oh, I want to talk a little bit about... Well, just more about mental illness. We'll do a little bit more on the other side here. Read an article from My Jewish Learning. I learn a lot from My Jewish Learning. I'm not going to read all of it, but it's an interesting one. Just make some more points about this topic, and then we'll probably get on to some other things. I'll probably still talk a little bit about the Jews. I might get into sun worship for just a little bit. You know, comparing what is supposed to be so evil, you know, having reverence for the sun, or even for trees, as compared to reverence for Yeshua and his father. You gotta love the rabbi and the big rabbi in the sky. Those guys are the ones to look up to. They give us so much. Not the sun or the trees. You don't need them if you have the love of Christ in your heart. That's the most essential thing. No, really, think about this. You could be completely free of knowing anything from Jesus or, you know, knowing anything of Yahweh. But as long as you still have the sun, as long as you still have trees, clean water, I mean, you'll probably be pretty good. But if you had Yahweh and Jesus and all that, but you didn't have the sun, or you didn't have trees, or you didn't have clean water, I don't think the Lord's going to provide. I think you'll be dead. But at least you can meet your maker. You can go up to the pearly gates and maybe you'll get in if you've been a good guy. Back for the last half hour. Stay tuned.
I've always believed that Britain is a country of migrants. I'm Jewish. Some of my family came in the late 19th century. I'm Sephardi on my mother's side.
The Liberal Democrats will always stand up for a Britain that is open, tolerant and diverse. And in that spirit, I very much welcome the Jewish European Election Manifesto, calling for a strengthening of EU hate crime legislation. As a party, we wholeheartedly value the relationship we have with the Jewish community, both in Britain and internationally.
Am Ende deiner Tage, das Ende einer Geschichte, wie ein Buch, das ich zuschlage. Ich seh dich
dich noch genau vor mir und höre noch dein Lachen. Ich wünschte mir so sehr, dass ich aus diesem Albtraum erwache.
Welcome back. This is the last half hour of the Solar Storm. So if you did want to get your voice heard, you got to call in now. All right, so this is from my Jewish learning, where we can learn about Jews. Honestly, there is some insightful information on Jewish sites. Turning to the Jewish sources is often very beneficial because they're willing to be more open when they're writing for their own as compared to when Jews are writing for goyim consumption. While Jews were instrumental in establishing the field of psychology, the Jewish community is not always comfortable dealing with those who suffer from psychiatric conditions. And isn't psychologist or psychiatrist the number one suicide position? People who are psychiatrists, I'm pretty sure that's the occupation that has the most suicides. An estimated 1 in 5 Americans suffer from some form of mental illness annually, and medical understanding of psychiatry and psychology has advanced dramatically in the past century. Nonetheless, psychiatric ailments continue to be stigmatized. And while Jews have been instrumental in establishing the field of psychology and are often stereotyped as being neurotic and more likely to undergo psychotherapy, the Jewish community, like society in general, is not always comfortable openly talking about mental illness or dealing with those who suffer from it.
We're perfect. We're chosen. We're not afflicted with mental illness.
Indeed, in some quarters of the Jewish community, there remains a great reluctance to discuss the issue at all, much less to relate to it as just another medical condition. This is despite the fact that references to mental illness can be found in some of the earliest Jewish textual sources. Hey guys, you ever see those rabbis on the plains with the big bags, plastic bags over them, the coverings, and they rock back and forth? Or just look at them praying, rocking back and forth, with the stupid cubes on their hats and their heads and arms and everything. Just look at their behaviors, their religious behaviors. They look insane. Do classical Jewish texts discuss mental illness? Oh, indeed they do. There is little direct discussion of mental illness in the Bible, though some have suggested that various biblical figures, most notably King David, may have suffered from depression. In the Bible, madness is described in several places as a form of divine punishment. In Deuteronomy, shigayon, an antecedent term for the common Yiddish expression meshugana, or crazy, is one of the forms of divine retribution for those who don't heed the word of God. So if you don't listen to Yahweh, he's going to turn you freaking insane. If you don't let the voice of Yahweh directly into your head and then his love into your heart, he's just going to drive you insane. So either you're insane for God or you're just an insane madman running around the streets. Either way, you're insane. Later in that section, God says that the Jewish people will become meshuga after a foreign people steals their crops and abuses them. The rabbis of the Talmud mostly addressed the issue in legal terms as a question of mental competence, their concern being principally whether someone of unsound mind is obligated by religious commandments. However, there are Talmudic sources that continue the biblical equation of madness and sinfulness. In Tractate Sota, the 3rd century sage Rish Lakish says a person only sins when the spirit of shtut, madness or folly, comes over him or her. Contemporary Orthodox writers have echoed both of these ideas, that mental illness is a form of sinfulness and a punishment for it. According to traditional Jewish law, someone who is mentally incompetent, a category known as shota, derived from the Hebrew word for wanderer or vagrant, is exempt from most religious obligations and cannot get married or bear witness. The Talmud describes such a person as someone who goes out alone at night, despite the dangers, or sleeps in a cemetery. Guys, you're just dealing with the vampires. You're a tribe of vampires. It's not too crazy to think that you got some people going out alone at night and sleeping in cemeteries. Signs of his or her detachment from reality. Maimonides said the shota is someone who runs around naked or throws rocks. It could also just be a drunk. According to the Israeli psychiatrist Raoul Strauss, the classic definition of a shota is essentially a psychotic. Echoing our contemporary understanding of the various forms of mental illness, the rabbis distinguish between those who are completely insane, those who cycle in and out of lucidity, and those who are insane only in certain respects. However, their understanding of the causes of insanity would not be embraced by contemporary mental health professionals. In Tractate Ketubot, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel warns that idleness leads to shimoan, which the commentator Rash equates with the biblical shigawan, craziness. Okay, so just one other point here. Look at the prophets, the people who saw all these visions, like Ezekiel. He would be diagnosed as a schizophrenic today. So even though they're saying that madness, a certain form of madness was a sin, they're holding up these other people who are obvious schizophrenics as being, I mean, not obviously schizophrenics. Maybe they saw something, but was it real? Was it real in their mind? What I'm getting at is people who, by today's definition, would be schizophrenics are the great holy people of these religions, or the Abrahamic religions. The idea that Jews are more anxious and neurotic than the norm is a widely repeated stereotype, one that has been attributed both to the many well-known Jewish neurotics who have played up their anxieties for comedic effect in film and television, like that funny Jew Woody Allen, as well as a tendency to celebrate Jewish anxiety as a sign of heightened intelligence. Hey, look at us, we're insane. But the scientific data does not support the idea that on average, Jews suffer from mental illness at higher rates than the general population. Yeah, you probably do. A 1992 analysis of data from NIMH found that the overall lifetime rate of psychiatric disorder did not differ among Jews as compared to non-Jews, even after controlling for demographic factors. The study did find that Jews suffer from certain mental illnesses at higher rates, including major depression, dysthymia, schizophrenia, and simple phobia, but had lower rates of others, including alcoholism. This finding echoes the results of studies conducted in the 1950s and 1960s that found elevated rates of neurosis and manic depression, now known as bipolar disorder, among the Jewish population. The 1992 analysis found that rates of bipolar disorder, panic disorder, agoraphobia, social phobia, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and drug abuse did not differ significantly between different religious groups. A 2007 study found that the frequency of mood and anxiety disorders in Israel is within the range of rates found in other Western countries. More recently, scientists discovered a genetic variation among Ashkenazi Jews that increases their risk of developing schizophrenia, which we talked about. But that genetic variant is also found among other religious and ethnic groups. In addition, researchers in the emerging field of epigenetics, which investigates how environmental factors can affect genetic expression, have found evidence that communities that have suffered from trauma and persecution, you know, like the Holocaust, can experience genetic changes that can then be transmitted to future generations. I do think this is true, but being a third-generation Holocaust survivor does not give any excuse to be insane or give you some kind of privilege to receive money. You know, honestly, we know that the treatment of the Jews was not bad at all in World War II, compared to what they've said. Jews obviously were not treated as, you know, treasured citizens in NS Germany. I'm not saying that they were. I mean, it's just, of course they were persecuted to a certain extent. And it was what they felt had to be done. But they weren't gassed and all this. But the changes that could happen to these Jews today, psychologically and epigenetically, would be due to not the treatment that their ancestors supposedly suffered, you know, the survivors, they somehow got out of Mengele's death camp. I got out of Mengele's experimentation table and somehow I floated over to the sink and I washed myself off and I ran out of the, you know, like It's not because their ancestor survived being experimented upon by Mengele. It's that they've heard these traumatic stories over and over again from the time they were born. So the Holocaust could potentially really be causing serious mental disorders in young Jews. If you watch the film, what's it called? It's not anti-Semitism. Oh, Defamation. Watch Defamation, made by an Israeli Jew. And he's not really exposing Jews so much, just part of the Jewish racket. I mean, this guy's not on our side, is what I'm trying to get at. But he goes and shows how these Israeli Jews who are taken on tours of the death camps are just taught to be the most paranoid people ever, that everybody's out to get them. They're going to Holocaust you again if they get the chance. This, the Jewish Holocaust industry, is potentially causing great mental illness within the Jewish population. It's not the Holocaust, the you know, what actually happened in the camps that's having reverberations today. It's the Holocaust industry. In the Orthodox community, considerable attention is now being directed to the prevalence of obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, a condition that can sometimes be hard to distinguish from a hypervigilance, sometimes referred to as scrupulosity, regarding the performance of Jewish religious commandments. Oh, now it makes sense that Henry Macau, how do you say it? The Jew who maybe turned to Christ, maybe? But he's born a Jew, and he has that website. I'm sure you've seen some articles from it, and it says that the NS Germany was, controlled opposition. That's one of his lines. He invented a board game known as Scruples. I wonder if that's related. Scrupulosity? I don't know if that it is related. Anyway, just a little tangent. Avigdor Bonchek, an Orthodox clinical psychologist and the author of Religious Compulsions and Fears, A Guide to Treatment, has suggested that one can distinguish between OCD behavior and healthy religious devotion in two ways. I love how they got to get an expert opinion. How do we differentiate between a Jew who's got OCD and a Jew who just looks like they have OCD but are really just dedicated to Yahweh? How do we distinguish? Looks like they're just kind of crazy. I'll tell you how. True OCD sufferers, he says, carry heavy stress and emotional burdens in their focus on strictly observing the commandments, and they demonstrate an extreme inflexibility that makes it difficult for them to violate commandments, even when religiously obliged to do so. The article goes on to ask whether there's a stigma against mental illness. Of course, yes, they're saying it's stigmatized, so people aren't getting treated properly and all that. But we're going to move on. I had another one from my Jewish learning I was thinking about getting into, but I don't think I'll do that here tonight. Is Israel and Anti-Gentile Traditions. And it talks about Israel Shahak, his book, Jewish History, Jewish Religion, from 1994. And how, yeah, some of the things they're saying about Jews thinking that their lives are worth a lot more than the rest of the Goyim. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there is a supremacism to Judaism. I think you know that. You get the point with that. There was another one I was going to potentially get to. I'll just mention it here. You probably heard this one. This is from Ynet News. I mean, these Jews try to portray themselves as the biggest campaigners against racism, as was cited in that article I read about Jewish mental illness before, about how they're so against racism in all of our countries, but Israel's the most racist state in the entire world. This article is titled, Chief Rabbi Cites Racist Comparisons Between Negroes and Monkeys. During lesson discussing blessings of trees and strange creatures, Sephardi chief rabbi offers Talmudic exceptional examples in which Negroes should be blessed when their parents are both white and they have a monkey. So this guy was saying the only time to bless a Negro is when it's a strange creature. Somehow if white parents give birth to a monkey, then it should be blessed because it's a strange creature and strange creatures should be blessed. It's just ridiculous what these people talk about. Who should or should not be blessed? And yeah, this guy's calling the black guy a monkey. Oh, they have a monkey for a son. They had a son like that. Yeah. But don't bless the black children that are born to black parents. Only if it's white parents who give birth to a Negro monkey. I mean, that's not made up. That's not fake news. That's from Israeli sources. But you don't hear about that. You really don't hear about these Jews in Israel calling black people monkeys. They are so anti-African over there. I'm not saying that people need to be pro-African, welcoming them into their countries, but compare them to, you know, maybe an anti-immigration rally here in the West. It's night and day. The Israelis are just hurling abuse at these Africans who are in Israel, and they're trying to get them out and send them on over to Europe. Oh, don't you know? Yeah, what I actually wanted to talk about here now is sun worship in the Bible. You got to be a complete schizophrenic lunatic with OCD to properly worship the deity of this world. Don't be looking up at the sun and the stars and the moon and the natural world around you. No. The texts of Yahweh's words. Focus on that. Focus on the insanity. This man-made insanity. Actually, I don't even know if it was man-made. Yep, probably reptilian. It's also a theory that, you know, it's some kind of AI from the past. Could be. So here's some verses from the Bible about how the sun was worshipped and how this was bad. Ezekiel 8:16. Then he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. This is terrible. They had their backs to the temple of the Lord, and they were doing what was actually their old ways, prostrating themselves eastwards toward the sun. Deuteronomy 4:19. And beware not to lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. Oh, you like the sun and the moon and the stars and all that? Don't worry about that. God gave that to you. So just worship God, because he gave you that. Deuteronomy 17:22-5. If there is found in your midst, in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, by transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the heavenly host, which I have not commanded, and if it is told to you, and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true and the thing certain that this detestable thing has been done in Israel. You know, so, okay, it's basically the NKVD. Oh, so we've heard you've been worshipping the sun. That is not allowed. A friend of yours is relayed information onto us. We hear you like the natural world. You don't think Yahweh is good enough, so we're going to take you out back. We're going to torture you and shoot you. Okay. Job 31:26-28. If I have looked at the sun when it shone, or the moon going in splendor, and my heart became secretly enticed, and my hand threw a kiss from my mouth, that too would have been an iniquity calling for judgment, for I would have denied God above. So if your heart is enticed by the sun or the moon, and you get blow a kiss to them, you need to be judged. You've denied God. You are an evil heathen sinner. 2 Kings 23:5 through 11. He did away with the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the surrounding area of Jerusalem. Also those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun and to the moon, and to the constellations and to all the host of heaven. He brought out the Asherah from the house of the Lord outside Jerusalem to the brook Kidron and burned it at the brook Kidron and ground it to dust and threw its dust on the graves of the common people. He also broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes which were in the house of the Lord, where the women were weaving hangings for the Asherah. Well, male cult prostitutes in the house of the Lord, you still got those going on these days. Isn't it interesting? Male cult prostitutes, boy cult prostitutes, in the house of the Lord. And, hey guys, the Abrahamic religions are all guilty of that one. Jeremiah 8, 1 through 2. At that time, declares the Lord, they will bring out the bones of the kings of Judah, and the bones of its princes, and the bones of the priests, and the bones of the prophets, and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem from their graves. They will spread them out to the sun, the moon, and to all the host of heaven, which they have loved, and which they have served, and which they have gone after, and which they have sought, and which they have worshipped. They will not be gathered or buried. They will be as dung on the face of the ground. Whoa. This is really harsh. They're digging up the bones of anybody who has worshipped the sun or the moon or the host of heavens. And they're going to let their bones be as dung on the face of the ground. It's pretty serious. Jeremiah 43:13. He will also shatter the obelisks of Heliopolis, which is in the land of Egypt, and the temples of the gods of Egypt. He will burn with fire. Ooh, a righteous fire. We cannot have iniquity in this house. Worship in the sun? Oh, no. That sun is wicked, wicked, wicked. No, I mean, the sun is given you to you by Yahweh. Do not worship it. It is just a creation. It's just so stupid. It's so insane. All of it. What most Christians don't even realize is that Jesus, that God, is Lucifer. It's even spelled out in their stupid Bible. They just refuse to believe it. I got so much heat when I published this article a while ago, the Christian Savior is actually Lucifer. And I went through and I showed how, yeah, kind of reach Renegade Tribune. Anyway, at the end of the book of Revelations, Revelations 22:16, Jesus comes back on cloud. This is how it ends. Hey, it's me, Jesus. I just want to tell you all, I'm Lucifer. So he says, I'm from the line of David, and I'm the bright and shining morning star. I'm Lucifer. Because if you look earlier in the Bible, since I can't pull up this article for some reason, thanks Jews, I can't get the exact quote, but it's referencing Lucifer as being the morning star, who Jesus proclaims to be right there at the end. And if you use simple English gematria, which is ABC equals 1, 2, 3, and add up all of the letters of a word, you do it for Jesus, it's 74. Let me see if I remember. J10, E5, S19, U23, and S19. You add those up, you get 74. Lucifer. L12, U23, C3, I9, F6, E5, and R18. Add it up, you get Lucifer. Add it up, you get 74. Now, 74 is G, D, because you get 7, G, and D, 4, D. Our big American holiday is actually on 7/4/2, 4th of July, right? And actually, simple English gematria, that's what this is when we're getting these answers. Simple is 74. English is 74. Gematria is 74. It's a big key number here. Very important. And ruler, 74. Masonic, 74. I'm pretty sure Muhammad. Yeah, if you spell Muhammad in one of the popular ways, it's spelled all these different ways. It's 74. So this is a big key here. And actually, Manuel P. Hall in The Secret Teachings of All Ages wrote, Lucifer is the greatest mystery of symbolism. The secret knowledge of the Rosicrucians concerning Lucifer is nowhere so plainly set forth as in these plates, which virtually reveal his true identity, a carefully guarded secret about which little has been written. Lucifer is represented by the numbers 741. Of course, 74, 741. Yeah. Well, there's actually a Catholic mass. I could have played some of this where they're singing about Lucifer. I mean, it's in Latin, but they're saying Lucifer. You can hear them saying Lucifer, even if you don't understand the other words, and there's captions there. They're singing a Lucifer over there. It's obviously the god, the savior for this cult, especially the Roman cult. But it's like the hidden little secret that they don't want you to know about. It's the key. Actually, I'm pretty sure the key is 74 as well. Well, I'm pretty much running out of time here. And I'm not even saying that Lucifer is the devil, is Satan. There is a lot of baggage with it, but if you really get down to the light bearer, the light of the world, you'd probably be talking about the sun. I know people say it's the morning star Venus that heralds the coming of the sun, but the big light of the world is obviously the sun. And so Jesus is the Son of God. Basically, they just put their rabbi in front of the sun, and they got the halo, the corona, going around his head. Get to the pure thing and just get rid of all the other garbage. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back with you all again soon. Take care, everybody. Thanks to the supporters. Really appreciate it.
You're a slave to the capitalist system. Is ruled by the global elite. What happened to the individual? What happened to working class white? The fed is head with so much.
Here is Rabbi Steve Guttel, who was president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here.
And here's an interview with Rabbi Goldschmidt.
Essentially, what you're saying is that in this boat, you're together with both Muslims
yes.
And people of other communities.
And we see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers.
Thanks, Jews.